Want to try a free sample of berry pie?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
One bite will destroy your body.
Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com. Cygnos.com with code SPARK. Cygnos.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
I want to show you again that Rolls Royce that crashed into this building.
I tell everybody all the time, test my gangster, right?
Oh, God.
Not listen to me. I tell everybody, test my gangster.
They was not scared of Suge Knight. They was terrified.
Often rappers prop up the image that they're tough or gangster in order to sell their music and push their career further. However, not all of them are really about that life, and when people who are really in the streets find out, serious issues can arise. And this is when cap rappers mess with real gangsters. Starting off with our first incident, when 6ix9ine, an extremely controversial figure in the rap world, messed with the 9 Trey Gangsta Bloods, which got him into some serious predicaments in life, to say the least.
Did I ever get kidnapped by them, or I got kidnapped by my own people?
I had no plans on snitching. If I got faced with 47 years and these guys was loyal and these guys was for me and these guys was my brothers and they showed me a bond that wouldn't break, I would have no choice.
That's cool, but now you gotta get violated. Yeah, super violated.
But before anything else, we need to go back and retrace the steps to understand just how 6ix9ine even got himself into this mess. And by mess, I mean his beef with the dangerous American street gang, the 9 Trey Gangsta Bloods. At one point, 6ix9ine was just another rapper trying to make it out of New York. And despite coming from a modest immigrant background, 6ix9ine managed to get himself involved in one of the most investigated crime syndicates in order to portray a street image. And it worked. After associating with the gang, 6ix9ine's music videos would reach hundreds of millions of views, and he'd become one of the hottest rappers out. Unfortunately for 6ix9ine, his antics would soon not be appreciated by some members of the 9 Treys, and they would teach him a lesson that he and many others would never forget. On the 22nd of July 2018, as 6ix9ine was coming home from the strip club after finishing filming his music video for Fifi with Nicki Minaj, things took a turn for the worse for 6ix9ine, as he would end up experiencing one of the scariest moments of his life yet.
July 22nd, me and Nicki are on the phone, me and Nicki are going through the video, and she's like, I don't like this part, can you change it? So I'm coming out the strip club, I go home, I'm on the phone with Nicki, she's like, switch this before the release tomorrow. I said, fine. I'm leaving the house, get in the car, we're driving to my friend's house.
That morning, 6ix9ine and his driver were apparently headed to a friend's house to finish editing the music video. However, it seemed like 6ix9ine could not get a hold of his friend.
I'm in the car, I'm calling my best friend, trying to get him to answer the phone so I can open the door. He's not answering, so I tell the driver, hit a U-turn, let's go back, he's not answering.
So they decided to head back, and this was the moment when everything changed for him.
When he hits the U-turn, we get hit by a car from the back. Boom! At that little side view mirror of the car, when I see a guy coming with a big just like hoodie on running towards my door, my heart dropped to my I'm like, this can't be happening right now.
I mean, wouldn't we all?
Opens the door, puts gun in my face, yo, give me everything, run everything. I'm like, oh, it got me. It's over.
Now, at this point, 6ix9ine thought he was getting robbed and jumped by some random guys. Little did he know that the threat in front of him was someone closer to him than he thought.
When I saw the person kidnapping me, I knew who he was, so I'm like, oh, it's over.
And 6ix9ine's heart dropped when he saw who was really trying to jump him.
So, you hear me plead, I'm like, yo, Hoff, chill, like, yo, bro, please, like, chill, like, I'm sorry, like, yo, I try to call you, like, I'm pleading.
The Harv that 6ix9ine mentioned was a man by the name of Anthony Harv Ellison, who was a member of the 9 Trey Bloods. Yep, that's right, someone who's supposedly part of 6ix9ine's gang.
Because I know, at this point, nobody's gonna know it's you. We're on a block intersection, 5 in the morning. All you gotta do is let off three boom, leave me there. Right?
But let's not get too ahead of ourselves. Because now you may be asking yourselves, who is Harv and why is he trying to harm 6ix9ine? As we've established, Harv was a member of the Nine Trays. However, for some reason, Harv did not like 6ix9ine, nor did he want him to be a part of the Nine Trays. The question is, why? Well, the animosity from Harv towards 6ix9ine wasn't necessarily his fault alone. Rather, it was also because 6ix9ine associated himself with another Nine Tray member, Shoddy, who then became 6ix9ine's manager and decided to protect 6ix9ine within the gang. According to Complex, Harv had a disdain for Shoddy and 6ix9ine because Harv thought Shoddy was a loudmouth who didn't back up his tough talk with action. And Harv was suspicious of this rainbow-haired kid acting like a gangster. So it seemed like deeper politics within the gang was putting 6ix9ine in danger. But simply having a disdain for someone being a rainbow-haired kid acting like a gangster couldn't solely be the reason for what they were about to do to 6ix9ine, right? Well, 6ix9ine had a different explanation as to why Harv had it out for him. According to him, Harv just wanted full control of him.
Upgrade your laundry routine with a durable and reliable Maytag laundry pair at Lowe's. Like the new Maytag washer and dryer with performance-enhanced stain-fighting power designed to cut through serious dirt and grime. And what's great is this laundry pair is in stock and ready for delivery when you need it the most. Don't miss out. Shop Maytag in-store or online today at Lowe's.
And wasn't willing to share his gains with Shoddy.
And they were beefing over money. Like, who had me, right? Because I'm generating so much money for the gang that they're like, he chose to be on Shoddy's side than Harv's side. I chose Shoddy and Harv didn't like that.
However, there was actually a notable incident which added more fuel to the fire. That was Harv's disdain for 6ix9ine and Shoddy. And this happened in March of 2018. At the time, 6ix9ine had gotten into it with J. Prince Jr., son of the feared Rap-A-Lot Records founder, J. Prince.
Type a lot of shit, huh? Yeah. But one of these show up to their own show. Goddamn, you don't want your back in, oh, yeah. You don't want your back in, what 6ix9ine
then? Apparently, 6ix9ine and Shoddy were denied entry to a party they were throwing because the two did not, quote-unquote, check in.
You see me, I invite you to test my gangster. But the problem, straight up, nobody want this problem. I'm telling you right now, y'all interview so many rappers. If I say I'm the king of New York for the 500th time, and someone didn't like it, something could have easily happened.
You're not the king of New York.
I'm the king of New York. Everywhere I go, they shut it down like the president is coming. Like,
and if you're not familiar with the phrase checking in, it basically means to meet with or speak with the local street representatives to gain permission to move about freely in their respective local area. Now, 6ix9ine and Shoddy being denied from the party by J. Prince Jr. made headlines, which further angered Harv as he saw it as a sign of weakness and a disrespect to the Nine Trays because neither 6ix9ine nor Shoddy did anything about it. In a group text, which would later serve as evidence in court against a few members of the Nine Trays, Harv and 6ix9ine had a heated argument 4 days after the supposed incident with J. Prince Jr. The verbal spat between Harv and 6ix9ine started with the former asking, "Why don't y'all shake no barricades and scream, they the mafia?" A reference to Shoddy and 6ix9ine's wild behavior at strip clubs in New York. But of course, 6ix9ine, being unaware of Harv's hostile tone, replied nonchalantly with, "They didn't do nothing though." What 6ix9ine didn't understand was that, to Harv and every real gangster, gangs had rules. And that according to Harv, gangsters don't pick and choose their beef. The same way you're at a club should be the same way you're everywhere. But again, 6ix9ine never truly understood nor embraced the rule of the streets. And the problem was that 6ix9ine wasn't sensing how serious the issue that Harv had with him was, and deflected the conversation, stating, "This is some beef between you and Shoddy, and you using me to voice that." But this still doesn't explain how the situation escalated so far. Well, you see, the reason for 6ix9ine's lack of awareness in that situation was that in the back of his mind, 6ix9ine felt like he was untouchable due to how much money he was making for the gang. And logically, that makes a lot of sense. However, now that he had pushed Harv's button a little too much, Harv gave 6ix9ine a little reminder, stating, "We not your goons." But while 6ix9ine didn't think too much of it, replying with, "I respect it," Harv replied, "Respect this." Now that we're all caught up with who Harv is, as well as why he was so pissed off at 6ix9ine, let's get back to 6ix9ine's crazy story. At this point, 6ix9ine thought Harv planned on robbing him and ending him. However, Harv had other plans in mind that morning, which would not bode well for 6ix9ine.
"Get in the car before I shoot you." So I'm like, damn, if I get in that car, I'm gonna die. If I get in that car, I'm gonna die. Like, it's over. If I run, he's gonna shoot me in the back. What do I do? I'm gonna get in the car.
So 6ix9ine didn't only get robbed at gunpoint, he got kidnapped, which meant that Harv had even more sinister plans for 6ix9ine. And this is where he would find out what Harv's true intentions were.
"Let me get out the car. Hey, stop.
But while 6ix9ine was pleading with Harv and Shaw, the two gang members let 6ix9ine know they really weren't playing with them at all, and showed him what being about that life was really like. Harv didn't simply want to give 6ix9ine the beats and rob him. No, Harv really hated 6ix9ine. Therefore, Harv wanted to send a message, and that was that 6ix9ine was out of the gang, officially in every sense imaginable. But obviously, 6ix9ine wasn't about to simply let himself get ended.
I'll bribe him. I said, yo, I got $100,000 for you. I'll stay with you. Please, I'll stay with you. Like, hide me in the basement somewhere, and I'll give you the $100,000.
Like, and this sounded like a good proposition for Harv. So they reached an agreement. 6ix9ine's life for some jewelry. Sounds like a good deal to me.
While I'm telling him, pleading, like, you're sorry, they're driving right to the front of my house.
Now, at this point in the story, 6ix9ine mentioned how Harv and Shaw supposedly should not know where 6ix9ine was staying at, since he had already cut ties with them due to their argument. And this fact would be pivotal for another incident, which we will get to later. But going back to 6ix9ine's story, they eventually reached his house.
They asked him, who's upstairs?
Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered, like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches, but there aren't, right?
Right, because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
And I call you my mom right now. Call me Sarah, but ask no questions. Bring down my jewelry. She's like, all right, for what? I said, Sarah, stop. Bring my jewelry down right now. All right. Hangs up.
But while Sarah, his baby mom, did ask questions, it seemed that 6ix9ine knew well enough that things might get worse for everyone if he tried to make any commotion.
I stay in the back seat. Harv stays driving. Shaw gets out, goes, grabs the jewelry, comes back in the car. They said, yo, once we get the jewelry, we're gonna let you out. I said, all right.
But if you think the message Harv wanted to send was just about publicly destroying 6ix9ine's gang ties, making an example out of him, and taking his jewelry, which included a presidential Rolex, a spinning 6ix9ine chain, 4 fully diamond rings, a Cuban bracelet, and a My Little Pony chain. I don't know why he had a My Little Pony chain. You'd be wrong, because as you already know, Harv did not just dislike 6ix9ine. He hated everything about him.
Once he got in that car with that jewelry and I heard them tires screech, I said, damn, I'm dead. They got the jewelry, they killed me, so.
As we've established, Harv did not play around. 6ix9ine was about to get a glimpse of what the dark side of being affiliated with a gang was like. So despite 6ix9ine already providing them with the jewelry and getting on camera denouncing his membership in the 9 Tray, Harv wasn't going to let his message go undelivered to the world.
Drive to like a back street behind their house in like Smurf Village. Mm-hmm. Said, get out the car.
At this point, 6ix9ine was worried for his life.
I said, I ain't getting out the car. Because I know if I get out the car, you're going to shoot me in my back. They said, don't get out the car, I'm going to shoot you right now. So I said, all right, you're going to shoot me regardless.
Despite all the pleading, nothing 6ix9ine had said or done mattered. Harv was simply out for blood, and he was going to fulfill that no matter what, which was very, very bad news for 6ix9ine.
So I put one leg out, and I'm like getting out the car slowly like this, like, all right, bro, just chill. Once I reached like this, like both legs like almost out, I said, yo. They said, yo, come in.
But 6ix9ine wasn't that naive. He knew how ominous that come in meant.
They like, yo, come here, let me tell you something. I already knew what that meant. When you say, come here, let me tell you something, you about to hit me with a hot one.
And at that point, it was virtually over for 6ix9ine. But while they're going back and forth about how 6ix9ine was going to get, 6ix9ine had another trick up his sleeve.
I just took off. And at this time, I think I'm the fastest kid in the world.
And by trick, I mean 6ix9ine took the chance and ran away from Harv and Shaw as fast as he could. However, to Harv, this was nothing but a small setback as he was determined to see his sinister plans come to fruition. So he chased after 6ix9ine. But I guess 6ix9ine's guardian angel worked overtime that day because he eventually escaped.
I see a Uber, like a Uber cab driver. driver, I reach for his back while I open it. When I open it, I just jump in the backseat and close it. I'm like, drop, drop. Remember, I'm b***ing from my face.
However, the story doesn't end here, because it really seemed like 6ix9ine lived a life straight from Hollywood.
Like, shut the f*** up. Like, drop. I'm a die. Why this guy stops right behind the car I just got out of? We had a red light. I said, sir, do not turn your blinkers on. You're gonna make this right.
Like a scene straight from Mission Impossible, this intense moment really proved how near 6ix9ine was to meeting his maker.
See Harvin shot, like, I'm looking right at him because I'm in the car right behind him. And I'm trying to think, if they know that I'm in his car and they pull out the on the driver, he's gonna force me to get out. Like, don't move or we now.
Luckily, 6ix9ine did end up escaping the clutches of Harv. However, 6ix9ine would not go unscathed. In fact, it was far from that. As his good friend Academics would say, he was given a serious case of the beats from Harv and Shaw, eventually arriving at a hospital on Long Island where he got a CAT scan and concussion meds. A picture of his injuries would surface, and I have to blur them because it's YouTube, but the importance of this is that it would become the catalyst of the demise of several members of the 9 Trey Bloods. But remember, 6ix9ine was technically still a part of the gang, at least legally, and this was far from the worst consequences he'd have to juggle due to his involvement in the gang. Soon after this incident, the world of the 9 Trey Bloods and 6ix9ine would be shaken up as the gang's action got more intense and out of hand. It was only a matter of time until the feds caught up to them, and about 4 months after 6ix9ine's kidnapping, it would all come crashing down for several 9 Trey members. On November 18th, 2018, six men, all affiliated with the 9 Trey, were arrested by ATF in New York City, namely 6ix9ine, Shoddy, Mel Murda, Fubanga, Ish, and Crippy. The six men were arrested due to their involvement in some criminal cases, mainly a robbery on April 3rd, 2018, which saw several members from J. Prince Rap-A-Lot Records getting robbed at gunpoint in the lobby of their Times Square's offices, and a shooting at the Barclays Center on April 21st, 2018, which involved Casanova and his crew during their beef. 6ix9ine himself was facing a minimum of 47 years and a maximum of life in prison after being charged with 9 federal...
Want to try a free sample?
Oh yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
You only eat after you're walking 10,000 steps.
Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com. Cygnos.com with code SPARK. Cygnos.
Counts, including racketeering, conspiracy, firearms, offenses, and narcotics trafficking, for messing around and getting involved with the gang. But clearly, 6ix9ine was really not a gangster, and everyone knew that he didn't really do this. And thus, it was time for him to be real with himself. And on February of 2019, 6ix9ine did just that. On the 1st of February, 6ix9ine pleaded guilty to all 9 charges, admitting his guilt and testifying against his co-defendants, as well as full cooperation and an insistence to commit no further crimes, in exchange for reduced prison time. Now, as most of us know, what 6ix9ine did was snitch on his friends, which is obviously heavily prohibited within gang culture. In the 31 rules of the United Blood Nation, number 2 states that there will be no snitches in our organization. 6ix9ine's actions would surely not go unpunished by the 9 Trey Bloods if it was up to them. However, as big as the 9 Trey Bloods were, the criminal case surrounding the gang was much bigger, which meant that almost every law enforcement entity in America was locked in on their every move, which was unfortunate for 2 unsuspecting people. Jim Jones, who at the time was allegedly a 9 Trey member, and Mel Murda, a high-ranking member of NTG. Mel Murda and Jim Jones didn't take kindly to his actions. Thus, they plotted something sinister for 6ix9ine. The problem, as I mentioned, is that the feds were hot on their trail, and things didn't turn out too hot for them. In a leaked audio snippet of the conversation, Jim Jones could be heard plotting against 6ix9ine, stating, "That's cool, but now he got to get violated," which Mel Murda could be heard agreeing. Yeah, super violated. Super duper. He's gonna get up. But the icing on the cake for this entire conversation was when Jim Jones himself said something that probably helped 6ix9ine avoid some charges. When he said, "Tell that guy he's not a gang member no more. He's kicked out the whip. He was never a gang member. He was always a money ploy for the gang members." And even without this direct statement for the court, it was always somewhat of a known fact. According to many, 6ix9ine was just used by the feds to give many of the gang members much harsher sentences and make it much easier for the feds to indict the gang. Luckily for 6ix9ine, neither Mel Murda or Jim Jones would ever get the chance to quote-unquote super violate it, as because of his cooperation with the court, as well as some, let's just say, unfortunately loose tongues, 6ix9ine would get the better end of the deal. As on December 18th, 2019, 6ix9ine was sentenced to 2 years in prison, a $35,000 fine, 5 years of supervised release, and 1,000 hours of community service, avoiding the potential minimum sentence of 47 years. And the best part, he was released early. However, as we've mentioned, these gangs don't play around. They abide by certain rules and codes of conduct, something 6ix9ine never really understood. While 6ix9ine would be free from the Nine Tray Bloods after his imprisonment and subsequent release in August of 2020, the gang life would haunt him for the rest of his life, as he knew he might never truly be free from the gang's grips despite renouncing his affiliation with the Nine Trays, and those worries would soon come true. According to reports, on Tuesday, March 21st, 2023, 6ix9ine was working out at an LA fitness in Lake Worth when he was given a brutal case of the beats, so bad that I cannot go into detail nor show you any pictures without them being heavily blurred, but just know it was very, very, very bad. Reports also added that suspects also stole his white Balenciaga tennis shoes, iPhone, and the key to his Lamborghini. But you might be wondering, what does this have to do with the Nine Tray? Well, apparently, according to the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office, the three suspects were arrested and charged with assault and robbery for the crime against 6ix9ine, one of which was allegedly a high-ranking member of the Latin Kings, one of the largest Hispanic and Latino street gangs in the world. And again, if you're wondering what this has to do with 6ix9ine's situation with the Nine Trays, the explanation is that the Latin Kings are known to be the allies of the Bloods under the street gang alliance called the People Nation. The Nine Tray aren't the only gang that 6ix9ine has to look over his shoulders now for.
So we're here on behalf of the Order Hornets to let know you are not allowed in our city. You're not welcome here. Penitentiary rules are in effect. He will not come here. I am deadly serious about this.
And two, 6ix9ine will never be able to live the safe, normal life that people like me and you take for granted.
Hey man, this 6ix9ine here running. Oh, 6ix9ine here running. It's you. We got him running. He wasn't trying to bounce out.
All because 6ix9ine carelessly tried to be about a life he was never meant for. Speaking about a life someone was never meant for, this next rapper also had to find out the hard way. And we're talking about none other than Rick Ross, who had a less than pleasant encounter with the Gangster Disciples, who are among the most dangerous gangs in America, if not the most.
We're live here at Southeast 4th Street and 15th Avenue in Fort Lauderdale, as you mentioned. I want to show you again that Rolls Royce that crashed into this building.
But let's not get ahead of ourselves. To find out just how Rick Ross incited the attention and anger of one of the most established crime syndicates on the planet, we have to explore how this all started. And well, unsurprisingly, just like the previous rappers in this video, it started with a song. On June 29th, 2010, Rick Ross released a song called BMF, Blowing Money Fast. But it was also a reference to an infamous...
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast12. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast12. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
American crime group called the Black Mafia Family, hence BMF. Now, that reference isn't really what drew the attention of the Gangster Disciples, at least not immediately, because they didn't even seem to take notice of the song at the time of its release. In fact, it would take a whole 2 years after the song's release for the story to pick up. However, unfortunately for Ross, that would all change very soon. In the summer of 2012, Kevin Clayton, who was known as the chief enforcer of the Gangster Disciples, began a nationwide crusade, calling up his brothers in arms to harass Rick Ross and the entire Maybach music crew. And they really did not mess around. The question is, what was it about Rick Ross's BMF that compelled Kevin Clayton to rally the entire Gangster Disciples against Ross? Well, Clayton allegedly took personal offense to one specific line in the entire song, specifically the opening lines, "I think I'm Big Meech, Larry Hoover, whip it work, hallelujah." So Rick Ross just shouted out two names in the lyrics, Big Meech and Larry Hoover. But who exactly were these people? The first one, Big Meech, is the nickname of Demetrius Edward Flannery Sr., one of the founders of the BMF or the Black Mafia Family. But the second name mentioned is what really got Rick Ross in the sights of the Gangster Disciples. Now you may be wondering, who is Larry Hoover, and what makes him so important that almost the entire Gangster Disciples were up in arms to check Ross's disrespect? You see, Larry Hoover was the founder of the Gangster Disciples, Hoover was the leader of the gang and managed all of their operations, even while he was in prison when he was arrested in 1973, dubbed as one of the most notorious criminals in Illinois history. Larry Hoover was pivotal to the growth and development of the Gangster Disciples and its members. But if you go back and look at the lyrics of BMF, many fans didn't think there was anything offensive about Rick Ross shouting out Larry Hoover. However, Larry Hoover Jr., son of Larry Hoover, had this to say about Rick Ross's shout out of his father, and it all began to make sense.
Always had a problem that he said his name and then was said whipping work. You know what I mean? And he's fighting for his life. Mm. So I wouldn't want him to speak on him about whipping work and him and his federal case that he's dealing with right now is a case.
So Larry Hoover Jr. found Ross's mentioning of his dad in the song a bit wrong, especially since he thought that it further implicated Larry Sr.'s drug charges, which honestly makes a lot of sense. Now, Larry Jr. wasn't the only person who chimed in with a reasonable perspective on the matter. As a well-known rapper in the Chicago scene and an alleged gang affiliate in the area, JoJo Capone, also gave his thoughts on Rick Ross mentioning Larry Hoover.
Once again, it's exploitation. So even if he was trying to do a good deed and speak on his name in a record and salute him or whatever, my advice was, that's cool, but donate some proceeds to him and his family for legal defense.
A recurring theme in this video is that gangsters really do not appreciate when rappers use gang culture for profit, especially when these rappers are not really a part of the gangs. And such is the case with Rick Ross and the Gangster Disciples. But while Larry Hoover Jr. and JoJo Capone's reasons did not make sense as to why the Gangster Disciples went after Rick Ross, the GD chief enforcer, Kevin Clayton, had a completely different idea in mind about it all.
First of all, let me get straight. Larry Hoover don't have nothing to do with this, so for y'all take the tape back to try to put LJ and his dad in it, they don't have nothing to do with this right here.
You heard it right. So Kevin Clayton just used Rick Ross's shout out of Larry Hoover to hide his true agenda. But what exactly was his quote-unquote agenda against Rick Ross? Well, at the time, Kevin Clayton, as the chief enforcer of the Gangster Disciples, was looking to enforce his power over people that he knew would be beneficial to the gang. If you're thinking what I'm thinking, you've guessed it right. Because the agenda that Clayton and the GDs really had for Rick Ross was all about extortion. And Rick Ross had money. Lots of it. So, how exactly did Rick Ross get into the crosshair of the Gangster Disciples if BMF wasn't really the reason? The answer is simple. And it has to do with a divisive concept in the hip-hop industry called checking in, which I previously mentioned in the 6ix9ine segment. Just to get on the same page for some that don't know or may have forgotten what checking in means, in the context of hip-hop, checking in means that when an artist goes to an area, he has to notify certain street figures such as club owners, prominent hip-hop personalities, and in the case of Rick Ross, local gangs like the Gangster Disciples, in that area of their arrival, with implied monetary or material offerings. But apparently, Ross was too much of a boss to check in when he and the Maybach music crew had some shows in Atlanta, which rubbed the GDs the wrong way. And so, Clayton, not wanting to look weak due to Ross's disrespect, had to show some force to let him know who he was really going up against. And the video shows exactly how big of a force Ross was really up against.
Pulling up on you, we pressing up on you the whole Maybach.
The Gangster Disciples weren't playing around at all, because Clayton really rallied GD members all across the state to shake Ross up, letting him know he either had to give in to their demands or give up.
Whatever city, whatever state, pressure on. Same promoters, we letting your promoters know. Before you book Rick Ross, y'all need to talk to us, G. It ain't going down. Pressure, you see what I'm saying?
However, Clayton and the gang couldn't help but reveal their intentions.
We ain't gonna leave, release this pressure off your ass until you release this check.
Period.
You period. The come check, you gotta cut. And watch this. It's just not Atlanta. When we drop this on the YouTube World Star, you're gonna see a whole following of this.
And get your lyrics.
Maybach, Meek Mills, everybody, G.
It was straight up extortion.
Nothing personal, but tell your boss, man, he gotta get that check, boy, cause y'all in trouble.
But of course, this is Rick Ross we're talking about. He's the boss. He couldn't let the public see him as embarrassed for the apparent shakeup from the GDs he was facing, especially since the video went viral, and Rick Ross's boss image was essential to his music success, and he just couldn't let his boss image get tainted, so he fired back at the gang. But unfortunately for him, when he did so, it backfired badly. During the time the GD warning video came out, it coincided with several important dates and events for Rick Ross and the Maybach music crew. One was that Ross was on tour for his new album, God Forgives. I don't. Other than that, three artists from MMG were also at the peak of their careers, as 2012 was a big year for Meek Mill, Wale, and French Montana, meaning that MMG was firing at all cylinders that year, which also meant that the GDs really saw how much they could have profited from Rick Ross's tour. That during that time, Rick Ross suddenly announced the cancellation of the rest of the MMG tour. But could it have been just a coincidence? Or was there something at play here? Especially since prior to canceling the entire tour, Ross actually canceled just the North Carolina dates in particular, apparently due to an unforeseen circumstance. And I'm talking about that kind of circumstance. Nevertheless, while everyone assumed that Rick Ross canceled his massive tour because of the threats from the GDs, Ross needed to defend his honor, since, you know, you can't be a boss if you're getting shaken up by gangs. So, in a December 2012 radio interview, Rick Ross explained his side of the story.
I canceled the rest of the tour due to the promoter wasn't really handling his business, you know what I'm saying? Uh-huh.
However, Ross's explanation was a bit convoluted and suspicious, to say the least.
Canceled a date of mine. I was going to Tucson, Arizona.
Okay.
And I was really a few hours outside of the market when I realized...
Of Arizona?
Tucson.
Okay.
I believe it was Tucson. This was maybe a week and a half ago.
And of course, it couldn't be a Rick Ross interview without him doing some sort of power play.
And I just made a call to the dude, Sean G, and just let him know that ain't how we moved. The day I woke up and realized two more dates had been canceled. So I just felt like that was some power that I needed to take away from homies.
Rick Ross also had to address the elephant in the room, although it sounded like he was a bit too defensive about it.
So I canceled the rest of the dates.
Mm-hmm.
And never was it due to any threats. You know, I'm a certified man. I am a real boss. And this is something that everybody need to understand. Gangsters move in silence. Gangsters move in silence.
Now, one thing I need to remind you guys is that, as we've established, Ross's God Forgives, I Don't tour with his label, MMG, was a massive nationwide tour. The tour was supposed to span from November 2nd, 2012 to December 16th, 2012. And every artist involved in the tour was at their peak. So it's kind of questionable, actually very questionable, for Rick Ross to cancel such a massively lucrative and important tour just because of some apparent lack of organization and communication on the part of the tour promoter. I mean, Rick Ross was the boss, right? And if you're the boss, you can probably make some stuff happen to fix that, right? But it just seemed to coincide with a lot of things that he didn't want to mention. Ross also justified why he shouted out Larry Hoover in his song.
Anything about GDs, it's all about growth and development. Anybody that know anything about the old man, Mr. Hoover, that's why I put him in my song, because I respected his scriptures, his philosophies. Mm-hmm. It's all about support.
Surely enough, Rick Ross being Rick Ross couldn't help but further deepen the grave that he was digging for himself.
I was just in Chicago a week and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's the birthplace of the GDs. And if I go to Chicago to handle my business like I did, I have no problem going to North Carolina or
right.
South Carolina, where right. the ladies are brown skin, brown eyes, they got nice curls, and they make the best apple pie.
And if that wasn't enough, Ross even tried to mock the Gangster Disciples videos, which, as you'll see later, was not a good idea.
So if you screaming, cut a check, we need a check, ain't no checks getting cut. Ain't never no checks getting cut.
Well,
I don't play those games.
Okay.
I consider that extortion. We don't play like that. This Dade County.
So, it seemed like Rick Ross addressed the issue and handled it like a boss. He told the gang he wasn't gonna bow down to their whims and no extortion was going to take place. All good, right? Surely nothing bad was going to happen to Rick Ross. Surely him doubling down on his antics would mean that the Gangster Disciples, one of the most dangerous crime syndicates in America, were backing down, right? Well, no. As you can expect by now, the Gangster Disciples couldn't let Rick Ross's disrespect go unpunished. And so, they had to make an example of Ross. But before that, let me set the stage for you. It's January 27th, 2013. Rick Ross was about to celebrate his 37th birthday, and Ross was gonna go drink his favorite rosé. So he, his crew, and his girlfriend decided to go to Brickell, Miami to celebrate at the Floridian dinner. Normal stuff so far. However, things took a turn for the worse after the birthday celebration ended. As we've already established multiple times, the gang culture is as serious as it could get, with lives almost at stake, and thus, certain threats that were made really had to be seen to fruition. So, at around 4:42 a.m., as Rick Ross was driving with his girl in Fort Lauderdale in his Rolls Royce to his beachfront mansion, everything was still going great. Little did Ross know, he was about to face the consequences of provoking the wrong people. According to news reports, Rick Ross was driving a silver 2011 Rolls-Royce eastbound on Y Las Olas Boulevard near Southeast 15th Avenue when shots were fired. What was even scarier about the incident was that witnesses say they heard at least 10 shots from what seemed like a high-power rifle.
We're live here at Southeast 4th Street and 15th Avenue in Fort Lauderdale, as you mentioned. I want to show you again that Rolls-Royce that crashed into this building.
While no one ever truly confirmed whether it was the gangster disciples behind this, or it was just a random drive-by, it would just be too much of a coincidence to say otherwise. But let's get back to the story.
We're being told by people here on the scene, specifically the manager of the Floridian restaurant, that a famous rapper was riding in that car when someone opened fire at that car crashing into that building.
Luckily for Ross, despite getting ambushed, Ross and his girl only had minor injuries after crashing into the apartment building at 311 Southeast 15th Avenue in their attempt to avoid gunfire. In the end, Rick Ross more or less had to thank whoever was above looking out for him because he and his girlfriend managed to escape unscathed. However, while you might think that the Rick Ross gangster disciple saga would be over due to the failed attempt on Ross's life, well, there's one more thing we have to mention, because apparently, despite acting like a boss, it turns out Rick Ross can be reasoned with. You see, it's safe to assume that one failed attempt would not stop a gang from laying their wrath on someone until the job is done, especially a gang as established and as dangerous as the gangster disciples. However, that shooting incident happened in 2013, and Rick Ross is still alive and kicking all these years later. So maybe something happened. Well, something actually did happen. In a testimony from 2016, an Atlanta Gangster Disciples member named Markel White released some wild allegations against Rick Ross. In his testimony against his fellow GD members, White stated that Ross did give in to extortion from threats by the GD, as Ross allegedly gave $3 million to the Gangster Disciples, stating, "From my understanding, Rick Ross ended up paying like $3 million. The initial payment was supposed to have been six, but I think they worked it out to like three." Despite implying he was untouchable, even the great Rick Ross had no choice but to submit to the orders of the gang, allegedly. And while Rick Ross recklessly used gang ties to prop up his image, his next pair of rappers just had to make one small mistake for them to anger the wrong person. And while Rick Ross's mistake may seem small, this next pair of musicians made an even smaller mistake, but had far worse consequences. But for this segment, we're gonna have to turn the clock back a little, specifically back to 1992, a time when I wasn't even born yet. Now, if you're familiar with the history of hip-hop, then you might recognize this name, Suge Knight. However, he's not the victim from the story. I mean, of course he's not the victim. It's Suge Knight we're talking about. He's basically the boogeyman of the hip-hop in the 90s.
They was not scared of Suge Knight. They was terrified of Suge Knight.
Right.
I mean, terrified.
I know.
No.
I mean, it's no secret that Suge was not afraid to impose his wrath on rappers.
The funniest stories I heard, Suge had an apartment full of producers. I guess they wasn't coming up with the right songs. Yeah. He gathered them all up and said, "Look, either y'all start producing some hits or I'm gonna start producing some hits."
So, here's some context. Since I can't assume, maybe a few of you do not even know who Suge Knight is, nor do you know who his victims were. So let's start there. In the summer of 1992, Dr. Dre was working on his now iconic album, The Chronic. At the time, Dre had just joined Suge Knight to establish Death Row Records. And you see, this was a very tumultuous and dangerous period, since Dre had just left Ruthless Records, and Suge Knight allegedly strong-armed his way into getting Dre free from the NWA. However, during that time, Dr. Dre had heard of two brothers who had all the potential and just needed the right platform, George and Linwood Stanley, aka the homeboys only. Seeing their potential, as well as the Stanleys' desire to get signed with Death Row, Dr. Dre invited them to Solar Records to work on their music for The Chronic. But there was an underlying story to all of this. During that same year, the mother of the siblings had an untimely demise. To add to this, George's oldest son, who at the time was just 3 years old, had a drowning accident and suffered mental and physical paralysis. Now, as tragic as that might seem for George and Linwood, things are about to get much, much, much more disastrous for the two. And if you're thinking, is there anything that can almost match the level of distress that a mother's untimely demise, as well as a son's drowning accident, can do to people? Well, if that's the case, then you don't know Suge Knight.
And Mark didn't want to give that up, and they did some things to him.
He might have got a few punches, and he probably drunk about 20 shots of piss. You know what I mean? Literally.
Especially during a period when Suge was probably amongst the most dangerous men in the music industry, if not the most.
It was like, "Suge's outside! Suge's outside!" Everybody like, "Shug, Shug, Shug." It was running, dropping.
The question now is, how exactly did the Stanley Brothers become the subject of Suge Knight's rap? Well, as we've mentioned, Dr. Dre had invited George and Linwood to help him work on his album The Chronic. At the time, Suge had Death Row Records set up shop at the Solar Records building. But before that, there's an underlying story that links everything together. According to a lawyer named Virgil Roberts, who at the time was the president and general counsel of Solar Records, they had received a phone bill from the studio floor that was amounted to around $8,000 for a single month. And while this alone did not make Suge Knight mad, it was a warning from the founder and the owner of the Solar Records building, Dick Greiffey, who was also a co-founder of Death Row Records, that might have set off Suge Knight, as Griffey allegedly warned Suge about the costly phone bill from the studio floor, stating, "Look at this bill, this is ridiculous. If you can't get those knuckleheads down there to stop using the phone, I'm gonna throw you out." But again, where did the Homeboys Only crew fit into this? As we've established, George and Linwood had both been present at the building working with Dr. Dre, as they were hoping to get signed with Death Row. And at the time, they were working at the studio floor, the floor that accumulated the $8,000 phone bill. And so, one night, a pissed off Suge Knight, who had just been warned and told off by the building owner, Dick Griffey, went up to the studio floor. And well, that's when he saw the poor Linwood Stanley using the company phone. Now, having a glimpse of the type of person that Suge Knight was, we can safely assume that Suge acted rationally, right? However, there was another factor to the story that just made things so much worse for the Stanley brothers. More so for Linwood, because beyond the $8,000 phone bill, there was also another issue at play here. Allegedly, the phone that Suge Knight saw Linwood Stanley using was an exclusive company phone, and by exclusive, I meant that the particular phone was reserved from calls from the kingpin, Harry O, who was the main financier of Death Row Records. And what made things much worse for Linwood was that Harry O was in prison at the time with very limited telephone access. So you can only imagine how alarmed Suge Knight was at the whole thing. And while we can assume that because Suge Knight had a reputation for being a really dangerous guy, Suge calmly walked over to tell Linwood to stop using the phone, saying, "Say blood, don't be using the phone." The problem was that Linwood Stanley wasn't exactly put on game that when a really large menacing guy walks up to you and tells you to stop using the phone, you stop using that phone immediately, no matter who you're talking to on the phone or what you're doing. Plus, as impossible as it might sound, it seemed that Linwood probably wasn't familiar to who Suge Knight was, which shouldn't be that surprising because at the time, Death Row and Suge Knight himself didn't have the menacing slash infamous status that they would garner later on. So being the oblivious person that Linwood Stanley was at the time, he told Suge this, "Don't be coming at me with all that gangbang shit. I'm not from LA. I mean, I was literally speechless when I was researching this part." And if you think things couldn't get worse, well, don't stop watching now because these next parts are bound to give you secondhand embarrassment. Because allegedly, Linwood replied to Suge by saying, "Hey look, I'm one of Dre's guests. Go talk to him." I mean, if you've heard that phrase, digging your grave further, this was the absolute embodiment of that. But it gets worse. Of course it does. As Virgil Roberts told the story, when Suge Knight told Linwood, "I don't talk to him, I run this," Linwood made an even dumber mistake. As he told Suge, "Man, go leave me alone." Yeah, at this point, I was at the edge of my seat. And well, depending on what kind of person you are, you'll either enjoy the next part of the story and think to yourself that Suge Knight was justified in what he did, or you'll wince and feel very, very, very bad for the Stanley brothers. But getting back to it, as we know now, Suge Knight doesn't take kindly at all to any disrespect. And two, when Suge Knight retaliates, he doesn't just hit back. Suge Knight makes sure to take your entire soul, in more ways than one. And unfortunately, that's exactly what Linwood Stanley experienced, with George receiving collateral damage of equal amounts. After the exchange between Suge and Linwood, Suge had nothing but pure violence on his mind as he allegedly went out of the building to his car to get a firearm. What happened next came straight out of a mafia movie. Suge Knight, after grabbing his firearm, came back to the studio and began threatening Linwood. But of course, Suge didn't stop there. After telling Linwood to get off the phone, Suge allegedly proceeded to take the Stanley brothers' clothes. So, with their honor and dignity on the line, the brothers refused, and thus, Suge Knight had no choice but to oblige, so he let a shot off. And this shooting incident will be pivotal to the story moving forward. But back to the story. Things would only get worse for George and Linwood, because not only did they get their manlihood taken from them against their will, but using his firearm, Suge Knight gave them the beats until, let's just say, they did not look very good. But again, this is Suge Knight we're talking about, one of the most dangerous people in the rap game. As I've stated, Suge Knight takes souls, and after giving them the so-called beats, he gives another sinister warning, stating, "I could f*** you up, but I'm not gonna do that. But I know where you live. I got your driver's license. I know where your mama lives." Yup, that's right. He even took their IDs out of their wallets. But Suge wasn't done, because, as we know, he had a reputation of instilling fear in his employees. so not even the ones in the studio floor were safe from his anger, as he addressed them about using the company phone, saying, "And this is just a lesson for all of you. If you use that phone, I'm gonna f*** you up." But while George and Linwood were subtly threatened at gunpoint, allegedly, the siblings decided to inform the cops. As soon as they were released from the building, they saw a police car and filed a report on Suge Knight. At that time, Suge Knight had already been a hot commodity for the police. Thus, when the battered Stanley brothers, coming from the scene, had filed a report, the police stormed the studio and arrested everybody. Unfortunately for George and Linwood, the fear that Suge Knight had instilled in the people who worked for him was as strong as it could get, which meant that no one gave a testimony about what happened to the Stanley brothers. But there's still hope in the case. Remember when Suge Knight let off a shot? Well, the bullet would come back to bite Suge Knight, as it was proof the police could use to pin Suge Knight to the crime, as apparently the bullet he shot was still lodged in the wall when the police had investigated, as well as help George and Linwood Stanley sue him in civil court. Not only that, the evidence also gave the Los Angeles District Attorney the authority to charge Suge Knight in criminal court. This move made them the first of a long line of victims to hold Suge Knight accountable for his actions. Of course, this is classic snitching. And while politics and corruption almost muddied the Stanley brothers' civil suit against Suge Knight, fortunately for them, justice was on their side, with the judge awarding them in the case, as well as a more or less equal compensation for the pain, humiliation, and suffering that they experienced from Suge Knight, receiving $1 million settlement and a recording deal with Death Row Records in 1994. But despite the so-called justice that prevailed, the win itself was controversial, to say the least, due to Knight's plea bargain. Because despite the horrible things that Suge Knight had done to both the brothers, the case only ended up with Suge Knight receiving a 5-year probation and a 9-year suspended sentence. Still, a win is a win, right? Well, the fact that people barely know anything about the homeboys only music or who they are meant that the potential that Dr. Dre saw in George and Linwood didn't really come to fruition. This was probably because the damage had already been done to the careers of the Stanley brothers, who had barely even started to do anything in the industry before their incident with Suge Knight. And despite capitalizing on the record deal that they had won from the civil lawsuit, the progress on the album was delayed to the point that by the time the album was finished, Death Row producers decided that the album's sound was too old for the newer style of hip-hop that had emerged, and so the label shelved the project. Sadly, only more bad news came from the Stanley brothers' way. In September of 1996, Death Row was struck with a fatal blow as the label's biggest artist, Tupac Shakur, was involved in a tragic incident that would change the course of hip-hop history, and this would obviously have a major impact on Death Row and its artists. Only 5 months later, Suge Knight received a 9-year prison sentence for violating his parole. However, while that would seem like good news for George and Linwood, it was during this time that with Death Row's sudden drop in stock value, the Stanley brothers, who were signed as the homeboys only, were dropped by the label, and that would ultimately be the end of their career in the music industry. And what happened to the next rapper in this video isn't much better. And we're talking about none other than the infamous Blue Cheese lover, CJ.
"You ain't never do nothing for this jet. You never put on for Bloodhound Brim. You never did none of that. You was never Bloodhound. You was never Jet. You was never none of that."
But of course, how did he even get into this mess? As a regular kid from Staten Island to becoming so controversial that he had gang members furious at him.
"I gotta put black gloves on for that stupid—"
Specifically from one of the most dangerous and infamous gangs in America, the Bloodhound Brims. So let's set the stage to understand what really happened specifically and why and how CJ messed with the Bloodhound Brim. But to understand that, we have to understand a little bit of CJ's story. CJ suddenly rose to unprecedented fame in 2020 due to his song Whoopty, which was a hit drill song. Now, let's explore the song a bit more since the entire ordeal revolves around the song. See, before releasing Whoopty, CJ had been uploading his music on SoundCloud, and they were mostly melodic rap tracks with almost little to no real success.
"I was kind of just doing a music thing for fun. Like, I would make a song and put it out, you know, every few months, you know, see what it does on YouTube, see what it does on SoundCloud."
But CJ had planned on making it big in the music industry, so he had to make some changes and take a risk.
"Everybody was just telling me, like, yo, I can hear you on a drill song. Like, let me see something, you feel me?" So
keep in mind, CJ wasn't even really a drill rapper. And this is a very important thing to note, as CJ was barely making a dent with the SoundCloud music.
"Recorded Whoopty, that was my first drill record that I even attempted to rap on, you know what I'm saying? And it happened to be a hit."
He then self-released Whoopty on July 30th of 2020. And it's safe to say the song was a massive success, catapulting CJ into rap stardom. Whoopty went viral on TikTok, as well as getting a significant early cosign from Cardi B. Not to mention the rumors that CJ blew up because he was an industry plant and had an uncle who had some really deep connections in the music industry. But that's for another video. Okay, so with just one song, CJ became one of the hottest rappers in the game. Whoopty was getting played all across the US, on TikTok, and on streaming platforms. But what was it about the song that was supposedly pissing off the Bloodhound Brims so much? Well, for starters, the title itself, Whoopty, is a really important factor. According to CJ, Whoopty was simply his way of greeting his friends and other people in his neighborhood.
Pretty much it's just like a roll call, you know, whenever I see my guys in the street and, you know, that's how we greet each other. It's like a New York when people say, yeah.
However, what CJ forgot to explain, or rather just didn't really understand, was that the phrase Whoopty was a greeting used exclusively by members of the Bloodhound Brims to identify themselves as part of a gang. A man by the name of Michael Adams, aka Meezy, who testified in the Bloodhound Brim trial, even explained to the court what Whoopty actually means, legally. In the trial, when Meezy was asked how members of the Bloodhound Brim would identify members in prison, he had this to say. We would come to the locked-in quarters. We would say, Whoopty. What is Whoopty? It's a hound salute. And when you yell Whoopty, what were you expecting? Someone to say he recognized the hound whistle. And what did that mean if you heard that? That mean there's other hounds around you. And that was definitely a huge problem for CJ, because he was carelessly trying to shout out and make a career out of a word that had gotten people in trouble for even saying it. But the CJ show doesn't stop there. It gets way better. Since his song Whoopty had gone so big, and because people were questioning CJ about the word's usage, he decided he wanted to officially claim the word, and he did just that. In October of 2020, CJ filed a trademark application to literally own the phrase Whoopty. And well, take a guess on what happens next.
As far as him being ham, he's not ham. Then you gonna copyright our shit? You copyright our shit? Like, yo boy, your head not good.
I mean, that kind of sounded like they weren't happy at all. It sounded like they were a bit mad.
And I'm not gonna lie, bro. Like, you make me mad, bro. Like, gangster, bro. You make me mad, bro. Like, feel, sir.
And so, that was what set CJ on the sights of the dangerous Bloodhound Brims.
I gotta put black dogs on. That's stupid. Hold on.
Now, as we know, gangs really don't play around, especially for those under the United Blood Nation, like the Bloodhound Brim, who all follow their code. With that being said, members of the Bloodhound Brim surely did not take kindly to a kid rapping about the gang life and blatantly spouting out Whoopty to claim his affiliation with the gang like it's nothing. And CJ had to get checked. And I don't think there was anyone better to check CJ than the founder of the Bloodhound Brims, himself, Latique Johnson, aka La Brim, who was surprisingly very calm yet stern about his warning to CJ.
Yeah, this your boy, Latique La Brim Johnson. So first and foremost, CJ made a hot song, but the content that he used is not his content. So his foundation is based off a lie. He's not Whoopty. He don't know nothing about Whoopty. He just seen a fly splash and he jacked it.
And one really cool, I guess, thing to note about LeBrim's message to CJ was that he even gave props to the guy. I mean, the song was a hit, right? But LeBrim was also very direct to the point about what he wanted CJ to really understand.
But in life, you gotta show respect and you can't live a lie.
But behind LeBrim's chill and cordial tone was a grim warning to CJ. Not just for the supposed disrespect, but also for the life that CJ was trying to get himself into that he wasn't ready for.
Now you jacking something that they got dudes in jail for. There's allegations behind that word right there that made it such a splash for you to want to jack it. They gave me 30 years for a lifestyle full of allegations of a lifestyle that you talking about that you never lived. And that don't add up, shorty.
LeBrim also checked CJ for filing a trademark application for Whoopty, which is crazy, as it felt like CJ was profiting like a colonizer from the word that meant so much to the gang.
Like, you trying to take something from people that you can't take. So.
But there's even more to this than meets the eye, because it wasn't just CJ that was carelessly shouting out Whoopty that garnered the attention of the Bloodhound Brims. CJ did more things that might have angered members of the gang. When CJ released Whoopty, it was accompanied by a music video. But it wasn't just your run-of-the-mill music video, because CJ went all in. And when I went all in, I mean the video had a Ferrari, a Lambo, CJ had a big dog on a leash, very important for a New York music video. There were beautiful women in the video, people in the video were throwing up signs, all of that. They even filmed the scene on a basketball court. But that just sounds like your standard rap music video, right? What was so special about it? Well, for one, CJ had alleged members of the Bloods in his music video. But it gets even more interesting, as not only were they allegedly Bloods in the Whoopty music video, but CJ himself was also wearing a red bandana to imply his own association with the gang. So do you agree with me now when I say CJ really went all in? Now, while you would think that the Whoopty music video and CJ's reckless use of that word were the only reasons to conjure negative tension from an entire gang, we also have to dive a bit deeper into the lyrics of Whoopty, because CJ really could not help but replicate the path that 6ix9ine took. In the song, CJ mentions the lines, "For Millie, we bringing them gas out. I still got some rack stuff in the trap house." Breaking the lyrics down, CJ mentioned bringing out the gats, which means Gatling, insinuating that CJ was getting involved in some gang activities. And next, he mentions having some rack stuffed in trap houses, meaning that CJ was also involved in some dealing. Okay, so CJ was claiming that he was about that life. It's essentially your standard gangster rap verse. However, where CJ really drew the attention and ire of the gang community was when he rapped the lyrics, "I'm posted up with the hats and the sleazies." If you're not familiar with the gang terms, neither am I, but a quick Google search could tell you that the word hats was another word that refers to the brim set bloods, while sleazies is most likely referring to the rapper Sauce Moolah, who's known as Big Sleaze or Sleazy, and was allegedly a member of an American gang called the Mac Ball of Brims. So it meant that CJ was claiming to be involved with the Brims and broadcasting his affiliations with them for the whole world to know. But again, as we've learned with 6ix9ine, falsely claiming to be a gang member doesn't really sit well with the real gang members, especially when you've done nothing significant for them. And so, LeBrim had to set the record straight, which more or less destroyed any quote-unquote hood credibility CJ supposedly had.
"For the record, Whoopty is not CJ's. That belongs to the Jet. I ain't even gonna say it's just mine. It belongs to the Jet. It's not his at all."
But not only did LeBrim warn CJ about what path that word might lead him to, he also reminded CJ about the dangers of associating himself with gangs.
"So all that you speaking in them songs, they got some boys in the street, not my team, just speaking in general, that's really gonna save you about that mess."
Nevertheless, LeBrim ended his warning to CJ by subtly letting everyone know not to let a rapper from Staten Island recklessly and falsely claim ties with the Bloodhound Brims without consequences.
"Shorty, but for all my real glows, you know what it is, man. Whoopty, y'all know what it is. Stand on that, man. That's our shit. So don't let that little boy play with y'all, man. And I'm not promoting violence, beef, or nothing. Just speak the truth and let his ignorance die with his fables and his foolish content."
And with that, any traction, momentum, and respect that CJ had, along with his music career, had suddenly been destroyed. And while CJ did try to do some damage control, such as him doubling down that he really was about that life, stating in a response to the criticism, "Rip-off, industry plant, one-hit wonder, or false claiming, it's like you're judging me off a YouTube video. You don't know my life, you don't know what I've been through." But the damage to his street cred had already bled into his rap career. And in the words of DJ Academics, numbers don't lie. Because in February of 2021, CJ released his debut EP called Loyalty Over Royalty under Warner Records, and despite the album being executive produced by French Montana and being backed by his uncle who had deep connections in the music industry, Loyalty Over Royalty barely made a dent, selling a mere 12.5k in its first week. And that was pretty much it for CJ's career. Okay, so before we discuss our next rapper who messed with the wrong people, let me show you a picture. With just a glimpse, if you know anything about the history of hip-hop, you might assume that the big guy holding a cigar looking menacingly at the camera might be the most dangerous guy in that picture. In some cases, you might even be right. But for this segment, you're gonna find out why some people in the rap world implied that this menacing guy, who people call the boogeyman of hip-hop in the 90s and early 2000s, was only ever afraid of one person, specifically this guy. And if you don't believe me, I'll just let this well-known artist do the talking.
"Like, do you go with Suge? He's like, well, he's a gangster. You don't want to get killed. Do you go with Easy? You hear all the stuff talking about, oh, he was taking the money. So we thought, oh, we'll go with the Church Boy. We'll go with MC Hammer, but he was the most gangster one of all."
So who is this Church Boy rapper who is supposedly the most gangster one of all of them? And more importantly, who was the unfortunately naive artist who tried to mess with them? Well, first of all, meet MC Hammer. See, on the surface, if you barely know anything about him or his music, you'd probably just see him as an artist who dances left or right on stage wearing genie pants while saying, "You can't touch this." And you're not necessarily wrong, because the way MC Hammer presented himself was completely the opposite of how some of the most gangster rappers would dress and act. However, beneath the flashy and comical showman exterior lies a man who most of the icons in the rap world would tell everyone not to mess with.
Hammer physically fit, bro. He might put blenders on him. Never know. You feel me?
Even Outkast had to warn everyone how dangerous Hammer really was.
"You talking, you know, talking about Hammer, but run up on it.
But apparently, one uninformed rapper didn't get the memo, or was actually delusional enough to think that he was about that life. And this rapper's name was MC Search, who was a member of a New York City-based rap group called Third Base. The question is, what happened? What did MC Search mistakenly do to garner the attention of one of hip-hop's most harmless-looking artists? For this part, we have to rewind a bit to the 90s. At this point in time, MC Hammer was among the most successful artists on the planet. In fact, his records were some of the highest selling and highest charting records of his generation. Not to mention, his song, You Can't Touch This, had sold more than 5 million copies by the mid-90s. The song got so big and so iconic that it actually became the theme song for the Detroit Pistons basketball team during and after their second NBA championship campaign in 1990. But amidst all of his success in the music industry, there was an underlying issue that MC Hammer had been facing. Because of Hammer's public image, showmanship, and how different he moved, literally and figuratively, from the norm of the tough rapper persona, Hammer was also one of the most mocked and ridiculed artists by some of his peers, including legends such as Ice Cube, LL Cool J, Redman, and Run DMC. But that's a conversation for another time. Luckily for these artists, they each found a way to settle their differences peacefully with MC Hammer. But not all of them. Because the same could not be said for Third Bass, more specifically, MC Search. But how did the Third Bass become entangled with one of the hottest rappers in the game? So, remember what I said about the Third Bass being based in Queens, New York? That's actually very important to the story. For one, Run DMC was also based in New York, specifically Queens, and were amongst the most beloved and most respected artists of their generation, especially for artists based in New York. The thing was, while Run DMC were at their peak, MC Hammer was also on the come up and was looking to establish his name in the rap industry. So, how did he do that? Well, a quick question for you guys. In rap, what is that one method that rappers use that is a 100% guaranteed way to get the attention of people and let other rappers know you're coming for their spot? I'll give you a second. Okay, if your answer is to diss them, you're absolutely right. And that's exactly what MC Hammer did. See, in 1986, MC Hammer released his debut album, Feel My Power. On this record, Hammer was out to make a name for himself in the music industry. Among the ways he did this, as you can assume, was to name drop and diss the top artists of the time, which he did on the third track of the album, Let's Get It Started. On this song, MC Hammer challenged several artists, including Dougie Fresh, LL Cool J, and DJ Run of Run DMC, rapping, "Now get up out your seat because my beat is so complete, I'm moving everybody from A to Z. And when it comes to straight up rocking, I'm second to none. From Dougie Fresh to LL or DJ Run." And as we know now, the artist mentioned in the track really took things seriously. However, so did the Third Bass.
Well, the point was that he dissed Run DMC. And for me, being a Queens kid,
yes,
and having Jam Master Jay, may he rest in peace, put me in the game, it was unforgivable. Like, it was unforgivable.
So now that we know why and how the Third Bass got themselves involved into the situation with MC Hammer, the next question is, how do they manage to piss Hammer off? Let me introduce you to a track called The Cactus. The Cactus was the 14th track on the Third Bass's debut release called The Cactus Album. So what's so special about The Cactus? Well, what really caught the attention of MC Hammer was a certain line in the song on the song's fourth verse, where they rapped, "To a fossil pushing 58, all bags and her butt sags. In the desert, no price tag. A household tool and a stank hole." The Cactus turned Hammer's mother out, which was rapped by a member of the group named Pete Nice. People have always mentioned that in rap disses, nothing is off limits. However, MC Hammer would disagree with that. But let me explain that line. In 1988, MC Hammer released his second album called Let's Get It Started, a re-recorded version of his Feel My Power album. In this album, Hammer had a track called Turn This Mother Out. Thus, The Cactus Turned Hammer's Mother Out was basically a reference and play on word to Hammer's track. However, the reason I brought up the clever lyricism by Pete Nice is that the cleverness would also come back to haunt them, as it was the reason that Third Bass was not able to deny that they actually dissed MC Hammer. And the problem was, the group really did not understand how much trouble they had dug themselves into. And so, MC Hammer set to take his revenge. But who exactly was he? Well, born and raised in Oakland, MC Hammer's ties and experiences with the street life were as real as it got. In the late 80s, when MC Hammer started to sell records and gain overwhelming success, he brought his entire hood with him, putting his whole crew on his payroll, paying each person 40 to 50k a year. Quite a bit in those days. It was like Hammer created an army. And it's not even an exaggeration. Just ask EPMD.
We see like a whole f***ing sea of people. Can you imagine? Hammer got 30 on stage anyway.
Yeah, right. That's what he was right. Known for.
Hammer conducted himself with such power and respect that other rappers had no choice but to recognize or else. You know Hammer, he was a big dog, man. He got respect in the streets. He had come from a respected crew. They handled business. Him and his brother Lewis and the crew. Without spending any money, Hammer could have told some people to mess him up. But aside from his gang ties and having an entire mob, MC Hammer himself wasn't a pushover and had no problems personally running up on someone he had problems with.
You know, it's entertainment. So he tried to let me know. We sat down. He was like, "Yo, don't get it.
I'm a real gangster from Oakland.
Redman learned this the hard way when he dissed MC Hammer's family back in the day. MC Hammer was there. That guy approached me. He was like, Red, I'm gonna tell you something. You're young, but I don't allow anybody talking about my mom. You understand me? I said, yes, sir. And now the third base was also about to learn the hard way not to mess with MC Hammer. And this is how it all went down. While trying to promote their debut album, third base went on a press run and tour. And one of the cities that the group was scheduled to do their press run in was Los Angeles. Well, the problem with that was that MC Hammer, being from Oakland, had strong ties with gangs in LA. So you can already see how pleasant of a time the third base members were going to have. Allegedly, while third base were on their flight to LA, a call was placed to the president of Def Jam, from who was allegedly MC Hammer's brother, Louis Burrell, informing Def Jam's president that third base would be once they got to California. But there were so many more details that the third base were about to discover about MC Hammer's threat. And things would only go from bad to horrible for the group. As MC Search himself claimed, MC Hammer allegedly placed a $50,000 bounty on the third base, and it was to be carried out by one of the most dangerous gangs in LA, the Rolling 60s Crips. So, facing a threat on their lives, third base did what any rational rap group who had an entire American crime mob on their heads would do. They called bullshit and said that they were going to proceed with their scheduled press run, which was the day after landing in LA. But of course, Def Jam, the record label who third base was signed to at the time, wasn't about to send their artists to their demise. And so, Russell Simmons, co-founder of the label, made some calls and managed to assign a security team from LA to stay close to the third base for the duration of their stay in the city. The security they got? A man named Angelo White, whose nickname was Barefoot Pookie, rumored to be one of the original members of the Crips. And Pookie agreed to do his best to stop the hit if he could get a chance to sit with Michael Jackson for the American Music Awards. But getting back to the story, as we've established, third base seemed to not understand how much of a mess they were in for. They really did not take MC Hammer seriously at all. So with the imminent threat and a $50,000 bounty on them, third base decided to hit Beverly Center, a well-known mall in LA where people can just come in and hang out with their friends. What could possibly go wrong? Well, MC Search decided to take his girlfriend shopping at Louis Vuitton. According to Search, Barefoot Pookie greenlit the trip and went along with them. However, despite having security with them, unfortunately for Search, things were about to get serious. At the time, third base were just starting to get famous, as they were being dubbed as the rivals of the Beastie Boys, which meant that people were starting to recognize them, and some were even coming up to Search for an autograph. I mean, people recognizing you and coming up to you for an autograph because you're kind of famous, who knew that would have happened? Certainly not MC Search. Okay, so you have a $50,000 bounty on your head, you have an entire gang going after you, and now people are coming up to you left and right in an open area where someone could just possibly end you and no one would know who it was or what really happened. Sounds safe, right? Nevertheless, while MC Search was apparently signing autographs, he noticed more and more people were coming up to him, and his sixth sense started to activate.
I signed some autographs, and I noticed some dudes, and I'm like, oh, cool, people are coming around. I noticed a couple more dudes, and I'm like, oh, cool, signing autographs. All of a sudden, I look at this dude, he's pulling up a blue rag. This dude's pulling up a blue rag, he's going like this.
At that point, it was game over for MC Search, right? Well, good thing for Search, he had Pookie around.
And then I hear a whistle, and I hear Pookie scream, hey! And these dudes look up, he throws up signs. And then they pulled down their rags and...
I mean, his security really saved him. And that's when MC Search learned how serious MC Hammer really was.
Yo, this s*** serious.
So yes. You didn't know that whole time that they were going to come get you like that?
Hell no. I mean, they told me there was a hit out on me.
I thought it was bullshit.
You didn't take it. Come on. I'm from New York, kid. Yeah. Like, I don't know about gangs.
And MC Hammer definitely gave Search his much-needed reality check that day.
It's real. This dude was 5 feet from smoking me. It was real.
Now, if you were in the shoes of the third base, having a near-death experience would probably wake you up and inform you about the seriousness of the threat that was MC Hammer. But third base wasn't gonna fold just yet and tried to keep things professional. And so, the following day after the scary incident in the mall, third base was about to go on their LA press run. The group was set to appear on the Greg Mack radio show to promote their album. Apparently, among the programs scheduled for their appearance was a giveaway promo, which meant that they were about to receive some callers to see who would win the giveaway. But what they didn't know was just how deep MC Hammer's connections were in the music industry, and they were about to find out.
So we're on with Greg Mack, the Mack Attack.
Yes.
Which was the morning show then. We're about to pull the name, and he goes, oh, we got a special guest on the phone live from the American Music Awards, winning 5 American Music Awards. MC Hammer's on the phone.
Wow.
And I'm like, I'm like, this just
set us up.
I told you guys, MC Hammer's connections ran deep, but that was just the tip of the iceberg. In an attempt to directly address the situation and explain why he put a hit on them, Hammer had mentioned that he didn't like how third base had dissed them by mentioning his mother, which makes sense. At this point, the situation was still somewhat calm, but MC's search, having just experienced a near-death incident the day before, was about to do something that he would soon regret. Replying to Hammer, Search said this.
I'm like, look, we didn't diss your matriarchal. Nobody's talking about your matriarchal. If you feel that way, that's you. Why don't you come see me, you bitch?
And I mean, at least we can respect that he had some bravery. But back to the topic, after calling MC Hammer a bitch, MC Search was feeling himself and started to ask for more callers.
Goes to line one. Line one is like, yo, I love third base. Searching those dudes. I love those dudes. Next caller. Oh, I love Hammer. Third base is whack. I love Hammer. Next caller. I love third base.
And well, Search got what he asked for.
Next caller. Rolling 60. We coming. Boop. All right, everybody out.
Sure enough, the Rolling 60s had to check Search for disrespect towards MC Hammer, and the third base were about to find out what the consequences were for their careless actions. More so, Search's. So, with an entire gang out to get them, third base and their crew had to evaluate. But there was one slight problem.
And now, K-Day was on a mountain. It was on a dirt hill.
Right.
There was only one way up and one way down. And it was an AM station. And we're in the black van. We're going down.
However, MC Search's life was about to change for the worse.
And there's two 65s. And this dude pulls out a MAC-11.
And let me just give you some context. A MAC-11 is a 9mm machine gun with a rate of fire with 1,200 rounds per minute, which can empty its 30-round magazine in about 2 seconds. This means that if things were about to go down, within the span of 2 seconds, they would have been finished. But anyways, while you would assume that this time would actually be the end of MC Search and the 3rd base crew, God was once again on their side, and luckily for them, their guardian angel, Pookie, was there to save them just in the nick of time. And fortunately for the 3rd base, despite this traumatic incident, they were still able to finish their press run effectively by disguising themselves for the remainder of their time until they left California. But of course, when you experience something as traumatic as MC Search did, twice, it can take a toll on you. Sadly for MC Search, despite the incident happening over 3 decades ago, Search has yet to properly heal from it, which is honestly understandable. Search himself has been candid about the PTSD he acquired from the incident and has openly admitted his struggles. I'm not good. I've gone through 25 years of therapy, 3 days a week. I'm not good. Today, Search said he would just apologize right then and there.
If I get the opportunity to meet Hammer, I would apologize. Because now that I look back at it, I recognize that the wordplay that we did and how he took it, I understand how it could be offensive.
But not everyone is as remorseful. As next up, we have a rapper named GBO Gaston, a relatively unknown rapper who learned the hard way that there's real-life consequences to trolling on the internet for clout. And similar to a lot of these other rappers, Gaston, who mostly gained attention not for his music, but for his antics on social media.
What's up with that pit word, that rat? You know he ain't playing that. Hey! On the damn Miss Playboy, you cannot come back to your hood, you is a rat. Now pay where that shit no hand with me. 36, you can Joe Murphy, right?
In fact, you probably wouldn't even know Gaston made music if you looked him up on YouTube. But that's besides the point. But what separates GBO Gaston from others on this list, besides actually being famous for the music they made, is that while 6ix9ine and CJ were simply exposed for using their supposed false gang affiliations for relevance and to boost their careers in the rap game, GBO Gaston's elite level of internet trolling made him delusional and he ended up flying too close to the sun.
I mean, my thing is, bro, God forbid, if you go to jail, bro, you know you're gonna have to deal with the consequences in jail. That's what I'm trying to get at. You can't run from it.
I already made a song, it's called County, boo. When I hit the county, I'ma run my fades. I'm already You don't understand.
For the most part, many of the antics that GBO Gaston pulled on camera looked like a teen doing TikTok skits.
Burning right here. Look at the face. Show the face. Show us day on me burning. Look. Me spit on cut. Look. Show me spitting on cut. Spitting on day on me. Look. Don't cut in there. Day on me. All on the floor. I'm a for my set. Look at. Went to cut hood, right? Went to cut hood. I threw a booty hole at cut house and now cut day on me burning. I'm a for my set in the blur on me. And I'm walking on.
And honestly, it's kind of sad to watch him do these things because it seemed like Gaston was the type of person who didn't receive much attention when he was a child. I mean, just look at this.
Come back, nigga. Come back to the set. Stop hiding. Yo, day on me right here. Look.
Oh,
I'm out here.
Blur.
No one in their right mind would take that seriously. However, that's not really what got GBO Gaston on this list, because when you think about it, there are already millions of trolls on the internet that say anything for clout. But rather because Gaston was on a different level, as he had a bad habit of going beyond just talking smack on social media.
Adam, come outside and tell me this could. I'll bar out your house. Get off the arena, the doorbell. Stop with that popping right here. Man, homie, ringing Adam, nigga. Hey, stop popping. Hey, Adam, come outside. Stop popping in the interviews, come.
And this habit would eventually lead to an uncomfortable reality check for Gaston. See, despite acting like someone who's all about that life, GBO Gaston apparently doesn't even live in the hood. GBO Gaston actually lives in a suburban gated community in LA. And this was probably the reason why, despite doing cringeworthy yet dangerous things like this,
boy, put it down the floor, I don't give a f. I'm a n***a, got sick. I'm a damn homie. Mazi, what is that? Why the f*** you hiding? I don't give a f*** about none of that. I'm walking through the set. I own the city. I run LA. I'm a damn homie. Stop hiding from the gang. GBO.
No one ever tried to put GBO Gaston in his place, even if he had been disrespecting an entire city. But aside from living in the suburbs, GBO Gaston was probably never harmed by anyone before because no one actually took his antics seriously, just like in this Instagram Live.
I got a 55th right now with my blower. I got 55 high shots, nigga. Dead homies, nigga. I got 55 shots in the clip, nigga. On crib, nigga. No, I'm sliding right now. I'm gang sliding, nigga. Dead homies, bro.
Where they're laughing at Gaston like a little nephew trying to impress his uncles. With all that being said, GBO Gaston probably felt untouchable. To him, it was all just fun and jokes. He got a little clout and his viewers were entertained. That is, until GBO Gaston took things too far and disrespected the wrong person. And as you've learned from what has happened so far to the rappers in this video, when you mess with the wrong people, eventually, life has a way of bursting your bubble, and that's exactly what happened to Gaston. To be fair, it takes a lot to go too far on the internet, even with what Gaston was doing, but what you shouldn't do, and what GBO Gaston probably didn't understand since no one had humbled him yet, was that you can't simply disrespect a beloved and well-respected figure in the community and not expect any amount of payback. So what exactly did GBO Gaston do? Well, he just happened to diss an important figure who passed away, but not just any person, Nipsey Hussle himself. No, you weren't just hearing things. GBO Gaston really said that. You could say what Gaston did wasn't far from the usual things he does, but there's no excuse for what he did.
Yeah, we're missing Hustle Grave right now. My blower out right here. Nigga trying to spit on Cut Grave. Fuck this, he's not a dead homies, nigga.
And as if it wasn't enough, since Gaston still wasn't getting the attention he was craving, he did this.
Homies, nigga, nigga know where I'm at. You see the time and all that? 7:40, nigga, on a dead homie, nigga. You see the piss? Finna throw piss on cut on a dead homie's cut, look. Piss on cut, nigga.
If you've seen my previous video, which talked about Nipsey Hussle, or if you've simply seen him in candid interviews, or heard others speak of him, you know that Nipsey was probably one of the kindest and most humble people in rap. So it makes sense that the people of LA don't mess around when it comes to Nipsey, especially after his passing. And that was exactly what an unknown person tried to teach Gaston. One day, while Gaston had apparently gone outside of his home to get some Amazon packages, someone lightly checked Gaston and set him straight.
Why you diss Nipsey, nigga? To be honest with you. Yeah, nigga, don't be dissing niggas, my nigga. You diss the gang niggas I know, my nigga. That's the piece of all them niggas. Say sorry, bruh.
In this weird encounter, some random person caught Gaston lacking in his own home and checked him for outright disrespecting Nipsey.
F*** your weird ass up. I'm gonna f*** you. Don't do that shit no more, bruh.
I promise I won't.
Yeah, what's your name though? Gaston, right?
Yeah.
You was one of them weak ass.
But luckily for Gaston, and sadly for his haters, things never escalated into something more seriously.
Clown, apologize again for I spit on you,
man. I'm sorry for this and all the day.
Say Nipsey, bro.
I'm sorry for this and Nipsey.
Nipsey okay. Hustle, homie.
I'm sorry for this and Nipsey Hustle. I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Alright, weirdo.
Although, some people claim this was all staged. However, while nothing bad ever happened to Gaston that time, there was more to the story. And this time, his haters would be filled with joy. Because in February of 2024, Gaston set out to prove that he was really about that life by involving himself in an armed robbery with two other guys. Sadly, for him and his friend, the police were able to identify them as suspects for the incident. But it got worse for him. Because the charges that the police were able to pin him with, namely residential robbery, home invasion, kidnapping, and residential burglary, was serious enough that GBO Gaston was allegedly about to face 25 years in prison. And the good times for his haters didn't stop there. Because while he managed to get bailed out by someone named 600, just days after he got bailed out, there was more bad news for Gaston. On May 14th of 2024, reports came out that Gaston had received a proper dose of humbling in his own home and was given a case of the beats. After GBO, Gaston posted a video of himself showing what happened. It was brutal. And what's even crazier about the story was that the person who gave Gaston the beats was his ex-girlfriend's father. But there's more to the story than you might think. In an Instagram post, Gaston's ex explained that when she and Gaston first met, she was 15, and Gaston said that he was 19. It's already sounding really bad for him, but it gets worse, because apparently, Gaston lied about his age and was actually 21 at the time when they linked up. He even tried to justify his actions by replying to the girl's story, but obviously, that just made him look even creepier. He was basically trying to justify what he had done by saying his ex had been with older men and had initiated it, despite not being at the legal age of consent. And hopefully, this was a wake-up call for Gaston. And he learns. Our last incident has to do with a Mexican artist who isn't technically a rapper, but I think he fits in this video perfectly. Peso Pluma, a Mexican artist who tried to mess with the cartel and got into some really deep water.
Peso Pluma is being threatened by a Mexican cartel ahead of his October concert in Tijuana. The 24-year-old Mexican star who praises El Chapo in his songs, the banner read, quote, refrain from presenting yourself on October 14th.
But let's not get too ahead of ourselves here, because people don't randomly go from being a normal 24-year-old up-and-coming Mexican singer to suddenly having an entire deadly crime group trying to stop you from performing and actually sending you death threats via banners. So what did Peso Pluma do for him to suddenly become public enemy number one of one of the scariest, most violent, and most brutal crime syndicates in the world? Well, this all began in 2022, when after having two underwhelming albums, Peso Pluma would make some very controversial actions in order to move his career further. On February 4th, 2022, Peso Pluma collaborated with another Mexican singer, Raul Vega, on a track called El Belicón, a song with narco corrido themes that touched upon the local trade in the area, as well as glorifying the life, making one of the most brave and stupid songs a Mexican artist has ever made. Here's some of the lyrics. I guard my sector, armored Tacomas roar the engines, the four-wheel drive trucks carry the and my enemies fear me. Now, while narco themes are prevalent in Mexican music, it seemed like Peso Pluma was trying to poke the bear known as the cartel, some of, if not the most dangerous gangsters in the world. But aside from lyrics, the appeal of El Belicón didn't just solely come from the song's themes about trafficking. Peso and Raul had bigger plans in mind. As crazy as it sounds, to promote the song, Peso Pluma and Raul Vega further played into El Belicón's narco themes. Yep, these guys had no chill whatsoever. Peso and Raul already starred in a music video, and in the video, the two played the roles of members of a cartel. The way Peso and Raul did this was wearing bulletproof vests, carrying and pretending to take part in some cartel operations. And well, the marketing worked, as the song became huge on social media, gaining momentum after going viral on TikTok and Instagram with its music video and racking 10 million views on YouTube within just a month of its release. And the song itself did pretty well in terms of chart placements, as El Belicón debuted at number 50 on the Billboard Hot Latin Song Chart and peaked at number 46 after just 2 weeks, becoming Peso Pluma's first entry on the Billboard charts. So it's safe to say that their unique promotion strategy, if you want to call it that, worked. But as they say, everything in life has a price. And it wouldn't take long for the song to attract the attention of the people that he was singing about and portraying in its music video, the cartel. However, at the time, it didn't seem to bother Peso Pluma too much. He was still riding the high off of the success he received from El Belicón, especially compared to the reception of his first two albums, which flopped. So in the middle of that year, 2022, Peso Pluma collaborated with yet another singer, Luis R. Conriquez, on the song Siempre Pendientes, roughly translating to Always Ready. And this time, Peso didn't just garner success and reactions from the fans. Little did he know, there was another demographic that seemed to be aware of Peso's artistic choices, the Jalisco New Generation Cartel, and they were hoping to catch Peso lacking. The song itself was about the life and mindset of someone deeply involved in the operations of a cartel. The lyrics paint a picture of vigilance and power, with the protagonist, assumed to be Peso Pluma, asserting their role at the forefront of the organization's activities. Now, if that didn't seem wild enough, wait until we dig deeper into the actual lyrics. In the song, Peso Pluma and Luis mention several controversial figures in the crime syndicate world. One of the lyrics say, I take care of Mr. Guzman's territory. Now, if you don't know, the Mr. Guzman the song talks about can either be Joaquin Arvelado Guzman Loera, aka El Chapo, or El Chapo's son, Ivan Archibala Guzman Salazar, since the song actually mentions both of them. For example, one of the lines roughly translates to JGL I carry on my arms proudly, and JGL stands for the initials of El Chapo's real name. as well as with Ivan's flag, they're coming, as in Ivan Guzman, aka his son. So yeah, this guy really just name-dropped El Chapo and his son while being from Mexico. But who are these two and what do they mean to the story specifically concerning Peso Pluma? Well, if you only know El Chapo from pop culture, here's why this was so significant. El Chapo was the leader of the Sinaloa cartel and is considered by some to be one of the most powerful yet most dangerous people on the planet. And of course, coming from that territory, his son Ivan would also get into the dubious business that his father was taking part in, becoming the leader of the Sinaloa cartel after El Chapo was imprisoned in 2019. So clearly, Peso Pluma was playing a dangerous game with some even more dangerous and powerful people. However, if you thought ruffling the feathers of one cartel was bad enough, on the other side of this entire ordeal is the group who is considered to be the enemy of the Sinaloa cartel, the CJNG. Think of it like O'Block and Tocqueville. And guess what? The CJNG took offense to Peso Pluma since he was basically glorifying the leaders of their enemy. And these guys do not mess around, as Peso would soon find out. But how scary are they really? Well, the CJNG is deemed to be among the most violent and brutal syndicates to ever exist. The crime syndicate is feared by people of Mexico due to their trademarked way of going about their business, because nothing about the CJNG is covert. Their culture of conducting their business is all about public executions and broad daylight violence, letting everyone know just who it is they're messing with. And well, you'll discover later just how not subtle the CJNG are. But let's set the stage a bit. Siempre Pendientes. Released on August 15th of 2022. When the song was released, there was already immediate backlash from fans, critics, and the Mexican government. So it's not just the CJNG that Peso Pluma had pissed off. The reason for the backlash was that upon the release, a music video for the song, which of course featured Peso Pluma and Luis, was uploaded to YouTube. And it did great, receiving 2 million views in the first 24 hours. However, the music video in question was removed from YouTube 3 days later due to the public outrage. The source of the public outrage was that in the music video, you can see the two singers brandishing rifles in the desert supported by a large crew, which mimics, you guessed it, the cartel. And because of that, fans and critics of Peso Pluma were very outspoken against him for the glorification of cartel violence and promoting illegal activities related to the cartel such as trafficking and weapons distribution. Keep in mind, he doesn't actually engage in any of these, so in American terms, this would be considered cap. However, being blinded by the fame he was receiving, Peso Pluma would not let his critics, or anyone for that matter, stop him from trying to gain more clout. As on the 1st of October 2022, Peso Pluma had a live performance at a festival called the 8 Music Fest, organized for the 491st anniversary of the city of Culiacan. So it's safe to say it was a pretty big event. Of course, Peso Pluma had to perform one of his hottest songs at the time, Siempre Pendientes. Now, in an attempt to double down on the lyrics of the song and as a way to garner more attention, an image of El Chapo, yes, El Chapo, was projected on a screen for the entirety of his performance. He really did not care. And as you'd expect, this performance would cause widespread backlash from the audience, organizers, the city council, and people online as they took this performance as Peso Pluma basically glorifying the alleged violence and other illegal activities done by El Chapo and the Sinaloa cartel. But while the song itself managed to stir up controversy amongst the fans, critics, and the Mexican local groups and authorities, what about the Jalisco New Generation cartel? What finally served as the straw that broke the camel's back, or rather of the CJNGs? Well, for that, we have to fast forward to September. On September 10th, 2023, Peso Pluma was set to perform and close out the RHSBC Festival in Mexico City. Now, the R Festival wasn't just any kind of festival. That year set the first edition of ARRE. The event was promoted as the most important in the world for regional Mexican music, as it was the first ever festival dedicated to Mexican music, its culture, and roots. So almost all of the biggest artists at the time were supposedly there to perform, meaning that practically all of Mexico was watching, at least fans of music. And again, Peso Pluma was booked to be the closer slash headliner for the 2-day festival, which would only mean that the stakes were that much higher. Of course, the corrido genre was ever present during the festival. And while it seemed like every artist that performed in the festival had memorable moments, Peso Pluma's performance was remarkable for many reasons. And one of them in particular would stand out to CJNG. For his 10th song in the set list, Peso Pluma decided to perform the infamous track Siempre Pendientes that itself would serve to attract the attention of the cartel. But what really hammered the nail in the coffin was when he performed the line which went like, JGL, I carry on my arms proudly. And if you're thinking, yo, what's so bad about that? Well, right after, Peso Pluma would point to the over 100,000 people attending in the crowd, to let them sing that specific part. If you need a bit of a brush up, that specific part alludes to JGL or Joaquin Archivaldo Guzman Loera, who we all know better as El Chapo. So basically, Peso Pluma just made 100,000 people sing El Chapo's initials in unison. And of course, as you may have guessed by now, that was a big mistake and was something that the CJNG would not let fly without consequences. And let me just remind you guys about something. Peso Pluma was born in the municipality of Zapopan, Jalisco. Jalisco being the base of operations for the CJNG. I mean, it's basically in their name, Jalisco New Generation Cartel. And the fact that Peso Pluma was born in Jalisco, yet glorified the leader of their former enemies, the Sinaloa Cartel, was the last straw that made the CJNG feel like they could not take any disrespect any longer. And by now you may be wondering what was going on in Peso Pluma's head. Well, we probably will never know, because Peso Pluma himself has yet to explain why he chose to shout out El Chapo, instead of maybe Nemesio Oseguera Cervantes, or better known as El Mencho, who is the leader of the CJNG. As a matter of fact, the LA Times even mentioned that Peso Pluma refused to address the issue and just hung up the phone when questioned about it. Which in hindsight is smart, but looking back, it was a bit too late. Once again, in a 2023 interview with Pepe Garza, the subject about his affiliation to the cartel was brought up due to his multiple references to El Chapo and Ivan Guzman, his son, simply opting to mention that was all just performance art.
Y me pues me trataron de embarrar ahí, pero nada que no se puede arreglar. Yo le seguí dando para adelante con la carrera, y gracias a Dios vamos formando este castillito poco a poco.
Yeah, I don't think that one's gonna fly, bro. However, even after this, Peso continued to perform the song without omitting any part of the lyrics. So it may be a case of Peso Pluma doubling down on the incident to gain more clout, which, I don't know, either took massive balls or massive ignorance on his part. Probably a little bit of both. But in either case, it was clear Peso Pluma was biting off more than he could chew, because all of these actions from Peso were taken as provoking the CJNG by the group. And well, what followed next looked like a scene taken straight from Hollywood. The result of all these little jabs could only be described as terrifying, to say the least. Because as we've established, the CJNG aren't just some petty group to mess up. They don't mess around at all. And they immediately let Peso Pluma know that the disrespect to them would not go unpunished. Because on September 13th of 2023, just days after Peso Pluma's quote-unquote controversial performance at the ARRE Festival, Peso Pluma probably had one of the worst mornings in his life when he heard the most horrifying news anyone could imagine.
Days now, Peso Pluma is being threatened by a Mexican cartel ahead of his October concert in Tijuana.
A popular Mexican singer postponing several shows because of death threats.
So what happened? Well, immediately after his live performance, the CJNG fired warning shots to Peso Pluma to let him know that the song, the performance, and Peso's blatant arrogance and disrespect to the CJNG were simply not going to slide anymore.
At times, a banner was displayed in Tijuana on Tuesday threatening the 24-year-old Mexican star who praises El Chapo in his songs.
The banners, called narcomantas, which are cloth banners or bed linen with hand-painted messages, typically used by the cartel to make public threats or announcements, had nothing short of a horrifying message to Peso Pluma.
The banner read, quote, refrain from presenting yourself on October 14th because it will be your last show due to your disrespect and loose tongue.
Four large narcomantas, which were displayed all across Tijuana the morning of Tuesday, were signed by the CJNG to let Peso Pluma know just who he pissed off. And of course, not wanting to end up like the infamous Mexican narco corrido singer named Chalino Sanchez, an artist who also went up against the cartel and did not live to tell the tale, Peso Pluma had no choice other than to hide his rat tail hair and do as he was told. In the aftermath of all the threats, Pluma not only didn't perform in Mexico, he canceled several shows in the US, including a September 14th show in Wisconsin, Milwaukee. He was that scared. Or venues were too afraid to book him, fearing violence. He even canceled shows in Illinois and Indianapolis. Aside from those shows, obviously, Peso Pluma, fearing for his life and not wanting to have a quote-unquote last show, eventually canceled his October 14th show in Tijuana. It seems like Peso Pluma has yet to make any plans to do a show in Tijuana or nearby, and well, I think that's a good idea.